It's sometimes darkest before the dawn. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, Barry. It's very good to be back with you today. Here, we are separate again today. So if it sounds a little different than it has the last couple weeks, that's because we're in different studios.
Well, and Chuck, let's just to ease anybody's fears or worries, it's not because either of us has been put into isolation or anything because of the Wuhan virus. It's just because I actually got Skype working again on my laptop, so I am now able to do the remote recording that we've been doing in the past. So
it really doesn't help when your technology doesn't work, does it?
Well, you know, I think maybe sometimes we become a little too dependent on technology, but and I will have to say that, it was enjoyable the last couple of times we recorded to be able to run over to Shea Michaelis and record live in your spacious studios and get it done that way so it actually probably sounds better. But again, we're a technologically based society. Everything we do now is roaming around our internet, our email, our smartphones, and the like. And I think that that's good to an extent. It can also lead to some issues. I think we have more identity theft now than we've ever had. I think you've gotten more situations where your credit card information or things gets hacked from certain websites, and then you're having to deal with, and I've had to deal with this a couple times with my bank, where MasterCard has gotten hacked and had to reissue cards because just on the security point of hackers ended up getting all of this data with all these card numbers. And so it's very interesting that with the conveniences of life sometimes come the difficulties of life. And it's, I think overall, I think we would say that, by and large, people prefer being able to pick up the phone and text or call somebody across the planet in rapid time rather than having to send a telex. Do you remember, and some people still have these, but most people don't. And I laugh because it seems like, I deal with a lot of medical issues, obviously, from my situation that I've had
recently. Yeah.
And of course, it's so funny when you hear them say, well, can you fax us this? I'm like, fax? I don't have a fax machine. It's like I can scan it and email it to you, but I'm not faxing it.
Well, I have a fax to email system. I pay a fee to a company called eFax, and I maintain my fax number, and people can send things to that fax number, and those faxes come into my emails. And it costs me like $15 a month. And honestly, I've been thinking about shutting all that down because I get about 4 faxes a month and 3 of them are junk.
Of course. And there's another avenue that rises when you have all this technology is, and I know I've been seeing them when you get, I'm sitting here on the cell phone, you're working something, the phone rings and you look at it and it's a number from Texas or Idaho or California or Washington State or full well you don't know anybody in any of those areas. And of course, if you do make the mistake of going ahead and connecting the phone, what you get is the recorded robocall messages of whatever thing, because again, nothing's safe anymore. But of course, we've made it much safer with government policy because now it rings up. Now, I think it's hilarious because I get ones that say political call when it's a robocall, obviously. Yeah. But me being who I am and what I do, I connect those because it's like, oh, who's trying to call to survey me or do robocall me and what do they want? So it helps me to determine, I want to pick those up.
Oh, it's
most people would hang up on them, I know, but I want to pick those up. But then I get the one that I love that says potential spam. Yeah. I mean, that's what it comes up on the call screen, potential spam. And I'm like, well, God, I just don't want to answer this. Well, a couple times I did go ahead and answer it just being curious, and it was actually something I needed to deal with. It wasn't a spam call. It was something that I needed to work with. But who is the one who sets back and determines what is and isn't legitimate, what is and isn't. And I don't think we can necessarily, through policies or through politicians writing these quick burn laws, actually accommodate for what we have out there. I mean, sometimes you want to take some of these phone calls. Other times you don't. And yeah, is it inconvenience that you get a bunch of phone calls from the sign up for this credit card or your healthcare or your car warranty or whatever that you know are mainly garbage? Well, as soon as the auto thing kicks in, just hang up on them. I mean, that's as easy as it gets. But when we let the government come in and they get to determine what is and isn't legitimate, or they get to label things, I think we might end up hurting ourselves in the long run.
Yeah, because it never fails. In order to try and fix a problem, very often the fix is worse than the problem. And that's
oftentimes the case.
Yeah, because the fix has become so restrictive that you can't do anything. I mean, there are legitimate reasons to call people from a solicitation standpoint. I mean, I could foresee, for instance, this mess that they created in California. And I forget what the reason was, but they created a mess in California that essentially the law, if it was interpreted very broadly, and it wouldn't take much in California, what happened was that they outlawed private contracting.
Right.
And I think it was to boost unionization.
Well, yeah, that would make sense. Was it? That sounds like a normal way of doing it.
AB 25? Part of it,
yes, I remember that.
Part of it was to get at place. It's a Consumer Privacy Act, is what it is. It was designed to get at Uber and Lyft, basically.
Yeah, because you can't have those non-governmental actors actually being successful.
Well, think about this. Why don't a lot of people take taxis versus Uber or Lyft, if you're asking yourself that question? Now, out here in rural America, we don't call either. We get in the car and go into town. But if you're in a city, would you call a yellow cab, or would you necessarily call an Uber or Lyft? Well, most people will call an Uber or Lyft if they're familiar with it, because A, it's cheaper, B, it's easier to get than a cab sometimes, especially in the rain. Good luck getting a cab in New York City when it's raining outside.
Right.
Especially in certain neighborhoods. Now, you know, Uber and Lyft, the way it works is they know who you are before you get in their car. They know exactly who you are, and you know are supposed to know exactly who they are, because there are reports of sexual assaults and robberies from Uber and Lyft drivers, but they're exceedingly rare. And that is because, A, the drivers are screened, and B, you know exactly who they are, and Uber and Lyft know exactly who they are. You can't just sign up. You have to go through a screening process. So, is it a good idea? Yeah, and it's cheaper. Because why? They don't have to be licensed, and there's a reason for that. All they're doing is sharing a ride. It's a ride sharing. That's when you hear that term, it's a ride sharing operation. And what that means is, I'm going there anyway. I want to take people with me so I can get some the cost back of the trip. That's the premise.
Okay.
But politicians got to figure out some way to get a piece of the action. That's the bottom line. Rather than just taking it as an income, because you have to declare that as income, obviously. But to declare, you know, that's not good enough. We need licensing fees. We need fees. And so this is part of that, although it's not all of her. I haven't done an extensive amount of reading on this, but people were saying basically it outlaws Santa Clauses at shopping malls and in little stores. Because why? That's a private contractor. They're trying to downplay all that, but guess what, Barry? Somebody can shop a judge someplace that will come up with the interpretation that they want to put on it.
Well, that's true.
So, that's the deal. I'm not sure where I was going with that, but...
Okay, well, that's fine.
You know, it's one of the things that's... I know we were talking about legislation and regulation that go places where they weren't originally intended to go.
Well, yeah.
And this is, you know, the law of unintended consequences. You can shut an industry down by simply regulating it in the incorrect way. And that has been done. And it's been done on purpose. We're not outlawing the business, but what we are doing is regulating you to this point, and all the people that are being regulated say, I'd rather go pump gas than do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not giving you that information.
And well, and that's entirely up to them, too.
Now, where it doesn't work, it's part of the way that they've kept, well, let's face it, illicit drug dealers. I always laugh about this because people talk about anarcho-capitalism. And I said, gosh, drug dealers are involved in anarcho-capitalism, and so was organized crime in the 1920s. Because if you think about it, they had these giant money-generating businesses. Well, you couldn't go to court and sue somebody if they didn't keep up with their handshake contract. You, if Al Capone and Bugs Moran shake hands on territories and neither one of them keep to those territories, can you go to the local court and say, hey, he didn't keep up with his contract? Well, no, you can't. And you can't go to a body that's set up to arbitrate that. That was attempted in organized crime. Didn't work out. What can you do? Well, you get bigger thugs with bigger guns and more hand grenades and more abilities to make bombs, and you kill each other. Which is exactly mm-hmm. what happens right. in anarcho-capitalism if there's enough money involved. The idea that somehow binding arbitration is going to fix the problems involved, I don't buy. Now, I know our anarcho-capitalist friends will say that I built a straw man and I burned it. And to some extent, I will admit to that. But I'm not far off in my analysis. I will maintain. So,
well, you're probably right. I wouldn't doubt that a bit. So, but you know, Chuck, it's just one of those things that you know, just like with everything else, you know, we adapt. That's the thing that with this country, we adapt. Sorry, my box just like went goofy right there.
Well, yeah, again, technology strikes.
Technology is strickening.
It has stricken.
Yeah, it's just really weird. But okay, but sorry about that. No, but you know, that's the thing. You know, we're talking about all this stuff and how things, you know, change. And really, you know, we're going to talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Chuck. And that is COVID-19.
COVID-19, that's right. The coronavirus.
Which is the latest newer strain of pandemic bug that I'm scratching my head sometimes. I'm a little bit amazed. You know, we've had from SARS to MERS to Marburg virus to Ebola to you name it. We've had various pandemic type ailments that have assailed the citizens of the world, let's say, over the last, you know, dozens of years. It seems like we have a new one of these every 3 or 4 or 5 years. This one, Chuck, I'm scratching my head a little bit because, yes, I you know, from the early reports that you're getting about this issue, is this, you know, a viral, thing, COVID-19, is it, deadly? Yeah, absolutely. It's deadly. People are dying of it. But the hype and the hyperbole is off the charts. I mean, I'm looking at a supposed news site and their leader, I mean, they've got like 20 different little link leaders. And they're all, and it just seemed like they're all like, you know, trying to outdo each other with how horrid this whole thing is and how bad it's happened and how everything's falling apart. And I look at this and I'm like, can we maybe take a moment to step back for a second and just kind of treat this like we treat every other, you know, illness or things that's going on there is, get to figure out where, you know, where it comes from, how it spread, and then work on finding a way to mitigate the severity of it. Because you know, let's be quite frank, ladies and gentlemen, you know, when they say they have a vaccine for something or, you know, you get your flu shot, it isn't preventing it in any way, shape, or form. It's just lessening the severity of the symptoms if you happen to be somebody who contracts any of these, you know, annual illnesses or diseases. And really, that's kind of what's going to be happening with this as well. Now, they're talking, oh, well, it took us a year and a half to get a vaccine on the market. That's not what I'm necessarily hearing now. I'm hearing that, you know, things are pushing and that they may actually be dealing with having some combinations of things in order to treat this particular respiratory virus a lot faster than that.
That's called a cocktail.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I lean on your chemistry background for this.
That's called a cocktail approach, and basically what it is that when it gets into people's lungs, it wreaks havoc. If it stays in your sinuses in your throat, it's uncomfortable, just like any flu. But it's not so bad. If it gets into your lungs, that's when you're in trouble. And the people who are getting it in their lungs are generally high risk. And by high risk, you're over a certain age. And this virus, I was a little disappointed because I heard they started calling people, they said the elderly are at risk. And I said, okay, what does that mean? What is the 60 and above? And I'm like, well, oops. I really don't like to think of myself as elderly, but I'm in that category. The other people are people with, for instance, breathing issues, bronchitis, people who are susceptible to bronchitis, who have COPD or emphysema, mm-hmm. as they used to call it, if they have other lung issues. This virus causes a severe pneumonia, and if you're in that risk factor, if you are diabetic, apparently it's a risk factor, and I'm over 60 and diabetic, but I'm not a raging diabetic. Mine's pretty much under control. I have some problems around now when allergies kick in, because that will mess you up, and the virus itself will mess you up. But the fact is that is this virus more deadly than any other virus, any other flu virus? And the answer is, yeah, it does seem to be that way. The normal flu death rate, just the flu that, you know, sure. Is just slightly under 1%. Around the world. And this particular flu, this COVID-19 or the Wuhan virus, I realize we're not supposed to call it that because it's racist. Especially AOC, who basically said people are not going to Chinese restaurants because of this Wuhan virus. I'm like,
that's funny. I've been to Chinese restaurants twice this week.
I was going to say, it's an absurdity. I think we had Chinese earlier this week. We didn't even think about it. It doesn't end, but it's racist because people are not going to Chinese restaurants. Anyway, this particular virus seems to have a right around 3% death rate.
Yeah, currently.
But as it
spreads, there's no tell. And that's the thing that I've been kind of like saying or shaking my head over. Oh, you know, we're extrapolating all this. You know, 400,000 will die. Well, okay, wait a minute. You're assuming that the rate that it started at, where it's actually hitting populations, it seems like if you read all the things that are going on, the populations that are contracting it right now are the populations that you just mentioned that are in the high risk. They have comorbidities. They are more elderly. I mean, the majority of the deaths that have occurred in the U.S. already, and I'm not making light of this, ladies and gentlemen. So,
no.
I mean, you know, don't think that somebody dying from a disease like this or from an illness like this is light. It's very serious. But that all pretty large percentage of the deaths that we've had so far in the U.S. have all been in that upper category. They have been elderly. I mean, the largest number so far have been in one nursing home where the disease spread around.
Well, because, in the ward where people who were very ill were already
were already they're already experiencing other issues that were leading to, you know, their eventual demise. This just, you know, accelerated that. But as this, you know, as this works its way through, just like any virus does, it works its way through the population, and then it, you know, peters out. Either you come up with a vaccine to help lessen the severity of the symptoms, or, you know, natural antibodies kick in, and then pretty soon, you know, people are building natural immunities to these type of viruses, and it peters out, and then you get a, then you run your data and figure out, okay, what was our percentages of mortality in relation to this particular strain of virus. And, you know, so I'm really hesitant right now, and that's kind of the reason why when I see all this panic and everybody moaning and groaning and they're shutting down, we're canceling, you know, all these events and shutting down, and the governor of the state is issuing, you know, maybe issuing travel bans and other things and shutting down events and you name. Okay, again, let's think about this a little bit more with a step back. Yes, it's terrible for people who contract this disease and who actually perish as a result or a part of a result of this disease. But does that mean that we basically have to shut down the entire world over this? Or is that actually going to create a situation, Chuck, where the less we have the interactions to get this disease going and to kick the you know, bodily responses for people to figure out how to kill this bacteria, this virus, are we actually going to create a bigger issue? I mean, is social distancing and isolationism and quarantining everybody on the face of the planet the actual answer to this?
Well, from an epidemiological standpoint, yes.
Yes. Okay.
But what does it do? Well, first of all, I think there's some panic involved here. Although, for instance, Ohio State sent everybody off on spring break like normal, but told them not to come back. They're closed until at least the end of March.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a smart thing to do? Well, okay. You start thinking about how many of the students at Ohio State, and how many are there now? Like 60,000 or something.
It's close to 60. Yes.
You think about that. What percentage of them are from countries where very, very virulent strains are prevalent? You know, Korea, China, Iran, and now some other places. They're having some trouble in Italy. How many of those students? It's in the thousands.
Yeah, give everyone can be.
So telling everybody to stay home for some extra time after, especially, you think at spring break, what are they going to do? A lot of them are going to go home. They're going to go home and visit their families.
Go home.
And so what are they going to do? They're going to be out in the shops. They're going to be out in the clubs. They're going to be out, you know, just walking the streets, meeting their friends. A bunch of people are going to come back at least exposed, if not, you know, with the flu. For instance, I just saw a thing that Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, who were, you know, husband and wife, were in Australia to do something. And they both felt crummy, and they went and got tested, and they both have coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
So they're stuck in Australia for a while. We have a friend that's getting ready to go to the Balkans for a mission trip. And she has, we're wondering if she's going to be allowed to fly to the Balkans because of this mess.
Well, I mean, I know that last night the President of the United States got on an address to the nation where he basically has banned European travel into the United States.
Yeah.
From the continent. Now, obviously, he gave an exemption to Great Britain, but not to other, like France or Germany or other places in Europe. So whether that extends to, okay, if you fly out,
and you're an American citizen, are you going to be allowed to fly back in?
And the answer
That's a good question.
And the answer is right now, probably not.
If you're going to make a trip to the Balkans, it might be an extended stay.
Well, think about this. When you people were brought back that were on cruise ships and that kind of thing, where were they put? Immediately.
Military base.
Do not pass go. You are going to quarantine. And that's about it. You're stuck for 2 weeks. And if you develop symptoms, you're going to a base hospital and you will be there. And if they, you know, they determine you just got food poisoning or something, they'll keep an eye on you and they will test you for coronavirus. Now, you know, it's this corona thing. Everybody's on all this coronavirus. It's nothing new. A lot of the bad viruses we've seen in the past, H1N1, SARS, all these things, they're coronaviruses. The 1918 flu that killed a lot of people, at least ostensibly, was a coronavirus. Why do I say ostensibly? There is some talk that some of the treatments that were being used in 1918 and 1919, when the flu was so prevalent, was part of the problem. One thing somebody came up with was that one of the treatments was they were handing out aspirin willy-nilly. I mean, like people were taking aspirin by the handful because it was a fairly new drug. It was an analgesic, and it would lower your temperature. And honestly, Barry, one of the things you don't necessarily want to have happen when you are ill is have your temperature lowered.
Right.
Now, you feel awful when your temperature's too high, but that's how your body fights infectious agents. Because what happens is very often they hijack your cell replicating mechanism. That's how a virus mostly works. They'll hijack your cell replication mechanism and make copies of themselves. Well, your body runs your temperature up to stop cell replication.
Yes.
And so very often when we get a temperature, you know, as adults, we get a temperature of 101, what do? We go take some Tylenol, we go take some aspirin, we go take some ibuprofen, whatever. And you know what I do when I get an infection and I know I've got a temperature? I gut it out because I know I'll have that infection for a shorter period if I gut it out and suffer a little bit. Which is better? Well, personally, for me, it is gut it out, suffer a little bit more for a shorter period of time. Now, that being said, going back to 1919, it killed an awful lot of people who were in situations where they had no real, again, it's people who had lung problems. It's people who were older, but a lot of soldiers died in training camps. In fact, you know, that was called the Spanish flu because some of the most virulent forms took place in Spain. But you know where I think the origin has been traced to, guess where? Where would you think?
Oh, you mean the Spanish flu?
Yeah.
The U.S.
Yeah, in a military training camp in the U.S.
Yes.
Now, where do these things come from? Well, they're mutations. Basically, viruses stem from, in a lot of cases, the body cutting out junk DNA, and it ends up going from a species to a species to a species. For instance, the current coronavirus can be carried by dogs. A lot of people don't know that. Dogs can carry this thing, and it will jump species. There are a lot of viruses that will jump species, but they jump specific species. For instance, the HIV bacteria was a monkey virus. It came from monkeys. Other viruses come from cats. You know, cats get something similar called feline leukemia. It's very similar to human HIV, but it doesn't jump species. Humans can't get that from cats. You can't. The cat might have it. You might handle the cat. You can't get the virus. It doesn't have the proper attachment. Your body does not have the proper attachment ports, if you will, to have that happen. There are all kinds of critter viruses that we can't get, but there are some that we can. There are viruses that are carried by horses that humans can get.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Name an animal. Swine flu was called that because pigs were carriers. That being the case, yeah, they work on vaccines for these things, and one of the problems why I never take a flu vaccine. They always guess at the beginning of the flu season which one is going to be the active strain. There are inherent difficulties with taking vaccines all the time. I'm not a never vaxxer. I like living in a world where we have conquered polio mostly by vaccination. I have people that disagree with me all the time and argue against that. I'm like, well, you can do that if you'd like. But all I know is I don't have a bunch of contemporaries requiring iron lungs to breathe. That being said, these viruses mutate all the time. The 1918 virus basically kept coming back around. People don't necessarily know this. The 1918 virus, they keep waiting for it to reemerge. I'm like, it's not going to reemerge. It mutated out of business. It basically mutated and mutated and mutated to the point where it became less and less and less and less and less virulent, and eventually got to the point where it couldn't infect anything, and that strain is no longer any place to be found. It finally died out sometime during the mid-2010s. Okay. As it became less and less. And that's what's happening with this virus. This virus has already majorly mutated twice, and every time it mutates, it becomes less virulent.
Right,
which is why you're hearing about fewer and fewer and fewer. Even though the panic is there, there are fewer and fewer and fewer cases in places where the number of original cases, because you could get it twice. Remember this, you could get that twice. And part of that was there were two different strains. It is already starting to mutate itself out of its highly virulent stage. Now, it doesn't mean it won't be a problem here. I'm not going to kid you that I'm necessarily convinced that there's never going to be a corona or a serious problem. We are attempting to contain it, and there are people who've had it and been in the hospital, and it was like, it was basically not as bad as the regular flu. Well, those are the people where it went into their throat, nose and throat, and stayed there. Didn't go down into their lungs, probably because they had highly developed and immune systems in good shape. What does that mean for us? Well, it'll be around for a while, be my guess, but it is mutating more rapidly than normal from what I can gather. What's really going on? Why all the panic then? Well, first of all, we want to keep as few people from getting it as possible, which is why you're seeing schools basically going on extended spring breaks. I'm just noticed something in the paper about one of the local school districts has basically got a plan to deal with it, and that's one of the things they're going to do. The NCAA is going to be playing basketball games to empty arenas.
You know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I just looked at an article that basically talked about how the coach of the Nebraska basketball team has been hospitalized because he was coaching last night at a ball game. And sure enough,
he felt crummy. Yeah,
started showing symptoms and of whatever, you know, might be weighing on him, and they basically took him off the court and put him in the hospital, and they quarantined the team. But then they, after a few hours, let them go. So, It may or may not be a related illness, but, you know, again, it's a situation where people are, you know, getting really nervous about, you know, if they hear somebody coughing, all of a sudden they're
everybody's,
fearing for their lives.
Everybody's afraid.
And I don't think it's necessarily to that point, and I think your point about the fact that this virus is mutating faster than something like the Spanish flu did is actually a good sign, because the faster it mutates and the faster it weakens, the quicker that we get past this.
Well, here's the problem, Barry. So much of the hype that you're seeing, it's not bad to get people to think about their situation. If you go out in public, you know, you go to the grocery store and you exchange money or do anything like that, yeah, get some hand sanitizer. And if you can't find any, go on the internet and learn how to make it yourself. It's really easy. You buy some skin gel and you add a certain amount of isopropyl alcohol to it, and voila, you got hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
The recipes are on the internet. Go out and find them. Go buy some isopropyl alcohol and some skin lotion. I mean, it's really not that big a deal.
Now be careful. Now we'll have a run on
isopropyl alcohol. Yeah.
And skin lotion here pretty soon, and the shelves will be bare of it like they are of toilet paper.
Well,
some wag said, basically, you know, this is an upper respiratory virus. I'm not sure what good the toilet paper is going to do, though.
Well, yeah, I love this. I listened to Breitbart the other night, and they were talking about the toilet paper shortage, and everybody's like, look, don't panic. This is not a foreign-made entity. Toilet paper is made in the United States. The roller tubes are made in the United States. Even the plastic they put it in is made in the United States.
That's right.
So we really don't have a problem with the toilet paper shortage. You know,
as a matter of fact, there's a massive factory that was built in Circleville just this last year, the last 2 years, Sofidel. And what do? They manufacture toilet paper.
Yep.
And the building is probably over a quarter of a mile long.
It's huge. Yeah, it's huge down there.
Because they run those on one long strand. Yeah, basically, their production line is just one straight long line. And they run all that, and then it gets and rolls it, and then it cuts it. And so, you know, they have to have that link because, you know, if you think about it, you get your toilet paper at the store, you look at it, and it says, you know, how many sheets, da da da, da, and it says how many feet it is. Well, guess what? For them to roll that up on a roll and put it in that package, they have to have that length of run from the time that the paper feeds into the, you know, goes through the, whether they do the quilting there or not, the perforation of it, rolling it on the rolls, and then cutting the rolls to size, and then sending it off to packaging. You have to have a length of floor to do that. And this place down there, I mean, if you've ever been past there, folks, I mean, it just stretches forever. I mean, and it's, that's just all one long, big production line.
Yeah, it is. Well, let's go back to what's really going on. The above board and not necessarily bad idea that we're making people aware and making people self-aware and self-conscious about what they do when they have to go into public. Right. You know, that's good. What's bad? What's bad is that the news media that just spent 2.5 years trying, well, 3 years, now getting ready to go to 4 years, trying to make sure, A, Donald Trump didn't get elected, and then B, once he got elected, that he got impeached, and B, once he got impeached and was acquitted, now trying to find something else to pin on him so they can get rid of him in the fall. And think about Joe Biden, what you will, replace him with someone who will not last an entire term. The whole point is it has turned from it's not just informational, it is now political. And the news media, for the most part, the mainstream news media has made it clear that they will do anything necessary to get Donald Trump, and they're showing it in their coverage. It's being hypercritical. Now, I listened to Ben Shapiro last night, and he was a little critical of the federal response when the virus first became known, and I listened to what he, and I thought it was a reasoned case that the CDC responded slowly, and I agree they did. There should have been there were situations I listened to where essentially on the West Coast where the first coronavirus cases came in, essentially tried to get people to listen to what they were doing to test for it, and no one would respond to them, and they were asking for permission to do these swabs, and they said, you know, nobody would, we'll get back to you on that. I mean, weeks and weeks and weeks, and finally they said, bag it. We're doing it. These are the people that developed the swabs to determine whether it was coronavirus or not. And the fact is that they just, this is one of the problems we have now in a society where you have to have government permission to blow your nose. When you step out of the box and say, fine, I'm not asking your permission. You know, there's the old saying, it's in Latin on my family crest. And that is, it's better to beg forgiveness than be denied permission. Now, that sounds like an anarchic way to be, and sometimes it is. But there are some places where the federal government and the state government and the county government shouldn't be involved. And one of those is getting in the way of doctors testing patients to find out if they've got a virulent form of a virus. And, in fact, those government entities should be at the forefront of saying, not how many of those can you produce and how quick can we get them?
Yeah, exactly.
And they're not doing that.
And I think people are misunderstanding too, because these tests that they're talking about, from what I'm reading now, each quote unquote kit will do 400 to 500 people. So it isn't like, oh, we're only getting like 20 kits, and oh gosh, well, people are going to die. No, that's because these kits will do a lot of testing. But, you know, you said earlier, you also have to be showing symptoms in order to test. So there's an awful lot that goes into that.
Oh, absolutely there is. Absolutely there. I mean, like, look, we live in an era when in the old days, there was no way to tell except by symptomology or electron microscopy what exactly you were dealing with. And you could just barely see a virus. Right. Just barely see it with electron microscopy. You had to do, there were other ways to get identifying those things and that kind of thing. We live in an era now when we can sequence the DNA and tell exactly what it is and see exactly how it's mutated. We live in an amazing era, and thank God for that. Thank the Lord that he gave the insight to the individuals who have, in a stepwise fashion, come up with the ways of doing this kind of work. But the fact is that has the government gotten in the way? And by the government, I don't just mean the federal government, but I mean federal, state, local governments have gotten in the way. Why? Because everybody wants to be in control of how doctors do this and that. Another thing, both researchers and doctors in hospitals and in private practice. That shouldn't be the case. The FDA gets in the way. Somebody finds a new use for a drug, and they find out it works not necessarily for what the normal prescription is for, but for something else by accident. What happens? The FDA says that's not an approved treatment. Does it work? Yeah. Well, they want them to jump through the hoops and go through the whole mess of going through years of testing on a drug they already know is as safe as it can be. There is not a drug on the planet that doesn't have side effects because you're hijacking bodily systems to do things that you want it to do. But they already know it's safe for, you know, why can't it be safe for this other use too? Oh, no, right. You've got to jump through the hoops. Well, there are doctors who have gotten prosecuted for doing off-approval treatments with drugs, despite the fact that the drug is perfectly legitimate and being used for other things. They're not using it for the approved purpose, and therefore they get prosecuted. That's how the government gets in the way. And state medical boards will go with the FDA. Why? Because it's a symbiotic relationship. the FDA can go and say, look, the state board is with us. They understand what we're trying to do. Well, nobody else understands what you're trying to do. And we're just trying to keep the public safe. No, you're not. You're trying to keep the drug companies safe. And if somebody gets treated off approval, you may deprive the drug company of a revenue source because the drug that they're using may already be cheap, and they want to sell something expensive.
Right.
This is part of the problem with our current system. And I will agree with those who are screaming about that. Yeah, you're right. It is a major problem with our current system. What do you do about it? Well, you don't make the FDA stronger and medical boards stronger and governing bodies at the state level stronger, because that's not the problem. We have the, for instance, we have an opioid crisis because the state medical boards have practiced backpat cronyism in letting some of these guys write prescription after prescription after prescription for people who are clearly addicted to opioids. And the problem is that, you know, the old natural opioids, as addictive as they were, and I'm talking about heroin and those kinds of things, very addictive. Mm-hmm. The opioids are worse. Some people are addicted after the third use. This is why when I get prescribed something like that after a surgery or something, I use it as absolutely little as possible. I don't take one until I can't stand it anymore. That's why. I don't want to get addicted. And I know how easy it is to get addicted. But going back to this thing, we have to get government out of the way of testing and treating.
Yes.
Instead, and also on the converse, the government can't sit there and do nothing and spin their wheels as these cases are building up. So we are in a situation now. Again, I don't want to induce panic because I don't think this is going to turn into much. Are some people who shouldn't be dead going to die? Yes, they are. Is it going to happen in this country? Almost undoubtedly. The beauty of it is it doesn't seem to be affecting children much. It seems to be affecting adults in that high risk category. There are people in their 20s who have gotten it and died, to be sure, but they've got other problems. Again, it's asthmatics. It's people who are, you know, easily get bronchitis and that kind of thing. That's where the problem lies. And, I just want to make it clear. This is about politics. It's not necessarily about health. And pay attention. Make sure that you pay attention when they say, sanitize your hands. Don't go into places where, you know, you're bound to be with people who are sick. You know, it's not forever, man. For a couple of months. We're probably, by the end of summer, or by the beginning of summer, we're probably going to be, oh, yeah, I remember that coronavirus that hit last winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's going to be. Now,
that's the way it's going to be, yeah.
The 1919 flu? No, that lasted for about 18 months. It came in, hit really hard, went away for a little bit, and then came right back and was just as bad, and then just as quickly disappeared. Just disappeared.
Yep.
Because it mutated. So, yeah. Watch the politics, folks. I mean, Don Lemon was one thing I'll give John Kasich some minor credit for. He's a CNN consultant at this point. They bring him on so he can insult Trump, and they can put R next to his name as a Republican insulting Trump. Don Lemon got him on last night and asked him what he thought of the president's speech on the whole mess. And he said, I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. I, you know, showed mm-hmm. that he's, you know, doing this and that. And Lemon came unglued. How dare you
because
say.
They just want everybody to be. They figured John Kasich, of all people, would be, like, hypercritical of Donald Trump.
Exactly. And Kasich's like, and he's, it shows that he still has some modicum of honesty in his, you know, he's like, okay, it's an okay speech. I'm sure what he didn't say was what he was really thinking. I could have done better, which is what John Kasich says about everything. But that being the case, Lemon came unglued and came, you know, it's about let's get him. And, you know, there's an old saying about if you're, this is metaphorically speaking, folks, I'm not speaking literally, but there's an old saying that if you set out to kill the king, then you have to kill the king.
That's right.
And that's what Don, we set out to kill the king and they want to kill the king. It doesn't matter what they use. Doesn't matter, what methodology, what it's all about. That's what all they want to do. So, that being said, it's a, just watch the politics, and be careful. And you know, we, as this is going on, I mean, think about this in, from the political arena. What's the next debate going to be? You know, they thought they were going to force Bernie out because he did so terribly on Tuesday. I think he won two states that have almost no delegates.
North Dakota, and I forget what the other one was. So
Idaho, maybe? Or
no, I don't even think he won Idaho.
So, I don't know.
I think he won North Dakota, and there was one that was still up in the air.
There was one that
wasn't sure how which way it was going to fall.
Right, so. It was so close they couldn't tell. That being said, the next debate is going to be in front of no audience.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yeah. Now, personally, that's a good thing. First of all, Bernie's going to chew Biden up and spit him out. It's going to be a bloodbath, and I think they're pretty aware of that. They're trying to find a way, and of course, they've done what they've been doing all along, and that is find a way to keep Tulsi out because Tulsi would eat both of them alive.
Right, exactly.
And they're aware of that, and they don't want her anywhere because she would suddenly pick up support. In fact, the Democrats at this point, just to end this thing, the Democrats are doing this thing with no audience, ostensibly to stop spread of the virus. The real reason is that they don't want a bunch of people in there hooting and hollering for Bernie. They know the audience is going to get stacked with both partisans on both sides, and it could turn into something ugly. Like we saw down there in Texas at Biden's victory speech.
Uh-huh.
Going back to that, with they want to keep Gabbard out because she'll eat both of them alive. And now you've got guys like Van Cliburn and Clinton consultant. Jim Carville, coming out and saying, no, we need to cancel the rest of the primaries. The job's already done. We just need to stop all this. And Clyburn was very open. He says, we need to stop these things so that Joe doesn't say something that he can't get out of. That is a paraphrase. Yep. Ladies and gentlemen, they know they got a damaged candidate, a deeply damaged candidate, and they don't want him to say stupid things, which he did in Michigan. He said really stupid things in Michigan. If you don't know what it is, look it up. He's talking out of both sides of his mouth about confiscating weapons. He says, I'm not going to confiscate your weapons. And then he appoints Beto O'Rourke to be his gun control guy to go door to door to confiscate weapons. He says, I'm not going to take your guns. And then he says, I'm going to take your AR-14s.
Yeah, AR-14.
What's an AR-14?
And then basically cusses out a guy at a plant that he was at shaking hands with because I watched the video with this worker, and you know, he's like, basically they told us that morning he was going to be coming in, and I spent all morning trying to figure out, you know, if I got the chance, what am I going to ask him? And he started out asking him about, you know, Joe's commitment to union labor and, you know, to creating jobs. And then he kind of segued and said, well, you know, we support you for that. But, you know, many of the same people here are Second Amendment supporters. And, you know, we carry or possess, you know, personal armaments. And, you know, how are you going to get our vote if you're telling us you're going to take away our guns on one hand while giving us jobs on the other? And
Joe came unglued, which is
Biden came unglued, called him a bunch of names on video
that we can't repeat,
railed at him, you know, the whole nine yards. And honestly, it was very interesting, Chuck. Not a single handler of Biden stepped in.
Yes, they did, actually.
Well, they didn't until the very end.
If you recall,
and then he comes back around and does it again.
If you remember, he went to the one handler who tried to pull him away and says, "You shush." And then he told one of them, "I don't work for you."
No, okay. I guess I missed who he was talking to. I thought it was another one of the plant workers who was saying something on the side, and he was just calling them out.
It was one of the people that was coming in to try to disengage him because he was calling this guy. He says, "Let's take it outside." He bodily threatened this guy, and the guy says, "Look, he's nuts," and unfortunately, he's correct. This is one of the signs. I'm not a doctor, but this is one of the signs of senility. Well, actually, not senility, dementia. Joe is showing definite signs of dementia. He doesn't know which woman is his wife and which is his sister.
I'll give him credit on that one. I mean, he did say they switched places on me, which could have been the case, you know. And honestly, if you're up here and you're trying to focus on what you're going to say and everything else, and then somebody changes the background on you.
So, people that have watched that have said there was no place switching. He just was confused.
I'm just saying what he said.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, and it's slightly plausible.
It's plausible.
You know, that, okay, maybe they switched places on him, he got
that. Strange thing where he went into the we hold these truths to be self-evident, and then he goes off into the thing.
Okay, Chuck, I'm gonna play a little devil's advocate with this one just to have some fun. I am much more happy that Joe Biden actually can mess up that quote, that he actually might have read it one time, as opposed to Nancy Pelosi and others who talk a lot about the Constitution but don't have the first clue what it says.
Well, yeah, this is why they pulled this emoluments clause thing, if you don't know what we're talking about. We're out of time, so we're not going to go into that. Sure. But the emoluments clause is basically you can't take a payment from a foreign government. And they were trying to make a case because he rents hotel rooms to people from foreign countries. It's really too much. That being said, I want to let everybody know that, and you should chime in here too, Barry. We've been advertising the Relationships Under Construction banquet that was this last Friday night, and we want to thank you for those of you who participated. Thank you very much. You can still participate. Go to relationshipsunderconstruction.com. You can donate online. We do need your donations, but we thank you for those and thank WLRY for coming and get. Mike O'Reilly for sitting at our table, Mike and Kelly. We were very glad to have them, and we were glad to have their booth there. They had a display. So thanks to everyone who was involved in Relationships Under Construction. The work continues. We do need your donations, relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And Barry, you were at Bringing America Back to Life this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic conference. It goes all day Friday, all day Saturday. We had speakers from all over the place. We talked about issues regarding, beginning of life, end of life, and things in between that affect your life, including the whole transgender movement, and how to go about being more effective in advancing the cause of life. So it was great. If you missed it, it's an annual event, barring any, complete collapse of our civilization over a minor bug, we will be having it again next March in Cleveland. So, folks, just plan on putting it on your calendars now to take a 3-day adventure up in northern Ohio and join with nearly 2,000 other pro-life leaders and advocates who are standing up for our defense of life and all that's around that. I think you'll come away refreshed, recharged, reinvigorated, and ready to engage in the battle some more.
And that being said, we are out of time. You know what we think? We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.